Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show this week, friends. I do appreciate it, as always. Yeah, kind of an interesting weekend here for this guy. Kind of messed everything up. Ended up having to have a tooth pulled on Friday, sort of unexpectedly, a wisdom tooth that had to come out that I didn't think was going to ever have to come out. Hadn't had a tooth pulled in about 40 years, so that was mildly interesting. And then I promptly got a cold, and certainly not from the procedure or anything, just right on the heels of that. Don't really know who I was around that was sick, but got a cold. Yeah, so I totally jacked up the weekend plans. My lovely wife, Sylvia, and I were meant to have a nice home food and beverage program, kind of laying low, gearing up for all the Mardi Gras festivities next weekend and next week. And I totally jacked it up. I just completely jacked it up, pretty much laid in bed all weekend. Tried not to whine too much. That's kind of what I'm doing now, right? I'm whining. Yeah, I'm just telling you what happened. But apologies to my lovely wife. I will try to make it up to her in the coming days, hopefully here on the mend. But happy to bring this show here to you this week, friends. It is the return of our French Quarter Fest series, one of my very, very favorite program series that we do. We partner up with our good friends at the French Quarter Festival, the finest music festival on the planet. And then we also partner up with our good friends at Louisiana Music Factory, the finest record store on the planet, 421 Frenchman Street. And that's where we tape the shows. And what we do, if you're not familiar with the series, is we get local musicians who are playing the festival to come on the show. And of course, we talk about music, but we also talk about their connection in some fashion to food and drink. We talk about French Quarter Festival, what it means for them to play the event. And we also talk about other connected issues, preserving the culture, the importance of the generational aspect of music in this part of the world. It's a really, really fun series. And sometimes we kind of do a little bit of a mashup, if you will, of different musicians, different maybe generations or different genres, and put them together, and we just kind of see what comes out. And it's always a lot of fun, and this show is no exception. We chat with two excellent musicians, one the very fine clarinetist Evan Christopher, and we also talk with the very fine Latin musician Fermin Ceballos, who is primarily a guitar player, does a lot of merengue and cumbia music. He just moved to New Orleans not too long ago. Evan's been around for quite a while. But a great conversation with those guys. I've actually met Fermin in person not too long before we recorded the show at the French Quarter Fest press conference. And I've been knowing Evan for a little while, a handful of years. Just our paths would cross here and there. But two great guys, great conversation. Thanks to our friends at French Quarter Fest for putting that together. And thanks for Louisiana Music Factory for hosting. And of course, we do let you know all about the festival during the broadcast, so be sure to check that out. We do spin some music from those guys as we go in and out of the commercial breaks. And you'll find that if you go on the podcast there, if you go to our website, noladrinks.com, you go to the particular episode post, there'll be a listing of the songs and their titles and then which artist specifically, whose song it was. And that way you can find the music. And I would encourage you to go to Louisiana Music Factory to purchase the music because, yeah, that's a good place to go to buy the music. They specialize in regional music. Very, very supportive of local musicians. Just a fantastic operation. Barry and the gang over there, they do a great job. You can go to 421 Frenchman Street and pick up the music, or you can just simply go online and buy the music from them there. So that's what I would encourage you to do. Quick programming note for you, friends. Next week, we're going to be off. Why? Because it's Mardi Gras. That's right. And the radio version of the show, as you know, will be airing on Lundi Gras, which means I'm not going to be doing anything other than doing the Lundi Gras. And we'll be out, of course, on Mardi Gras. But we'll be back with a brand spanking new show the week after, assuming we all survive Mardi Gras. I think I say that pretty much every year, but that's the plan as it stands. And we'll let you know a little bit more about the show when we come back with a new one in a couple weeks when we have all that information put together. I think I pretty much know already what's going on, but we're just sort of crossing our T's and dotting our I's, as they say. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to bounce right over to Louisiana Music Factory for our featured interview with Fermin Ceballos and Evan Christopher, our French Quarter Fest series. Come on back.
Yo vengo de todos lados, venimos de todas partes,
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. Yeah, we are here at what I will say is the finest record store in the world, Louisiana Music Factory, 421 Frenchman Street. And it's part of our French Quarter Fest series, which I will say is the finest music festival on the planet. I'm a little biased. Happy to kick our series back off again here in 2020 and joined by two great guests, Evan Christopher. Evan, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, man. Good to see you. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And Fermin Ceballos. Fermin, how are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
My pleasure. Yeah. And I just, Fermin, you and I just met for the first time the other day. So it was nice to meet you. And Evan, you and I have actually met a handful of times over the years, including a case of mistaken identity.
That was my bad.
Yeah, we have a mutual friend in Tim Laughlin, who's a musician here in town, and we met about a little bit over a year ago.
Yeah,
at his
house.
A
couple years ago. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I took that as a compliment that you thought that I was Tim's brother. I'd like to be a hanger on that way. Well, you guys were here for the French Quarter Fest series, as we do, and what I'd like to do is start just ask you guys some questions in this first segment here about your music and about your background. I always hesitate. I never ask people, you know, what style of music do you play? I always like to start with the question, who are your influences?
Ah, nice.
Because I think that might tell people, give people a flavor of what it is that you do. So, Evan, why don't I start with you?
As a clarinetist, the New Orleans clarinetists were very influential, and they were part of what drew me here to the city in the first place around 1994. Sidney Bechet, very high on the list. Barney Bigard, who was with Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong, and then Omer Simeon, who was with Jelly Roll Morton. So I didn't know as much about New Orleans music. I knew the New Orleans clarinetists through their work, mostly outside of New Orleans. Well, you know, long after they left, most of them left at pretty young ages.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I was originally more captivated by what you might think of as say early jazz, and then when I got here and then learned about, you know, real traditional New Orleans music in addition, you know, then that expanded to musicians like Albert Burbank and Louis Cottrell and,
oh, wow,
you know, so all these wonderful clarinetists. But, you know, a lot of people on other instruments too, for sure. But, mm-hmm. but I mean, as a clarinetist, I always have to.
That you look there
no,
first.
Those are my,
right,
those
right,
are my,
right, right. Well, and I always appreciate, Evan, I've been familiar with your music for several years now. And I think, from my perspective, that you have a great sense of tradition, as you're saying. But then you also have a great sense of modernity, I think, in your music as well. It's sort of looking back and looking forward at the same time.
Thank you. I think we're obligated to do that whenever we're dealing with traditions, because traditions, to stay vital, they have to evolve and they have to serve people living now.
Mm-hmm.
So I never wanted to treat this music as a museum piece. And the musicians with whom I first met in New Orleans all sort of shared that idea of wanting to be active participants in a living culture, whether they were from here, whether they're from other places. And I didn't tend to gravitate towards musicians who had a more strict approach or a strict idea of what the tradition was.
Okay.
Because I found that the musicians who are active here in New Orleans rarely thought that way. Yeah.
Great. Mm. Awesome. Fermin, what about you? You're from the Dominican Republic originally?
Yeah, from the Dominican Republic. My influences it's also like just Dominican music as a merengue, bachata. But merengue and bachata is like very popular, I can say, worldwide now. But we have a lot of rhythms and a lot of music in Dominican Republic is unknown outside of the country. It's like, you know, sometimes you across the country in different states, south, west, or north, you have a small community who play different kind of rhythms, different type of music. Like, it's just only for that community. Some of them we call maboba, we call palo, we call carabiné. So this is very rich and very unique. And that influence, I think, make me a little bit kind of authentic. And, you know, but I also have influence from the Trova or Nova Trova, like from most Cuban artists, mm-hmm. and Spanish artists like Luis Eduardo Aute, Joaquin Sabina, Silvio Rodriguez, Pablo Milanés, and you know, talking names, I can tell from the Dominican Republic as Juan Luis Guerra is one of them. Luis Terror Diaz is like a great composer and musician who lived here for a long time and went back to Dominican Republic, and he began to start making fusion between blues, between rock, between jazz and root music from Dominican Republic that impacted me. You know, that was like really, I said, oh my God, I think this is awesome. So when I came here to New Orleans, when I get here, I believe the first New Orleans band that I heard and I saw live was Reverb Brass Band.
Oh, Reverb.
When I saw Reverb Brass Band and all the power of the horns, I said, oh my God, this is so rich. I think I can do something with my Caribbean music, with my Dominican music, and takes that skills from the horns parts and including on my music. And I'm been doing that now. But also, jazz and blues and music like that, to me, was like music that I heard just on movies and in the back in Dominican Republic, that's traditional jazz. And some places of the Dominican Republic, you can find that too. Now it's growing a lot. Now the jazz momentum in Dominican Republic is became big. But when I came here and I listen and I've been in touch with the authenticity of New Orleans music all the way, talking about old music in New Orleans, I said, oh my God, this is another way that I can, you know, take from, I can learn, and I can include this on my culture and my, you know, my music, on my arrangement. And New Orleans, for me, I call my second home. Because I learned a lot from New Orleans culture, New Orleans music. So I feel really comfortable living here and sharing my music with people and learning and making music with them. Mm-hmm. This is awesome. Also, I love, like, African music. I can tell a few names of Orchestra Baobá.
Oh, yeah.
Yuson Adore. Mm-hmm. Salif Keita. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's really rich, really rich music. And talking about some guitarists from here, like George Benson, Pat Metheny, you know, just that kind of more like of these days, but traditional jazz, like a Joey Pass, you know.
Oh, Joey Pass.
Just, it's
for sure.
Really good. And it's a hundreds of names that I can tell now, but sure. I feel really great here. Living here, making music here, and learning. I think we musicians, we learn every day, day by day, from others, from us also.
Yeah, always learning, right? And you're primarily a guitarist. I won't tell people that, but right?
Yeah, but also accordionist.
Oh, I didn't know that part. Oh, okay, cool.
My first instrument was an accordion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an accordion. So I play merengue and cumbias and all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, so, Evan, you're originally from California, aren't you?
Originally, that's right.
Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, near Long Beach, California.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, Southern California.
I grew up by Oakland, man.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, and you know, I know you draw from a wide range of music as well, and you've done a lot of gypsy jazz stuff in addition to, right?
That was a funny thing. I think the, you know, what you would call gypsy jazz or what the French call jazz manouche, you know, one of my most recent recording collaborations was with a guitarist of Romani descent. While I was sort of in exile like everybody else, so after 2005, I did kind of fall in with some people in France where I was and I started a group called Django Le Creole. But to be honest, to me, it was still just a New Orleans style band, with a different, slightly different instrumentation. And the premise of that was that Django recorded and collaborated with a lot of American musicians throughout his lifetime, mm-hmm. including Barney Bigard from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So the narrative of that particular project was really based on that collaboration and the combination of the two traditions. So I don't actually fancy myself as being a real aficionado of that genre.
Okay.
It just was part of a narrative I was following as I found myself, you know, in France, mm-hmm. and wanted to figure out a way to have a whatever would be the best combination of a French New Orleans project. And
that makes a lot of sense, right? That's logical.
Yeah. Django also, he replaced his violinist and with clarinet right before.
So
the,
after Grappelli,
the,
then he
as yeah. the war was breaking out, okay. Stefan Grappelli stayed yeah. in the UK, and he Django started using clarinet in his group. So there were a lot of recordings that I really okay. enjoyed very much of a wonderful clarinetist named Hubert Rostang.
Oh yeah, okay.
So that was really my entry into that world. I'm not. I don't have a very direct connection to it. The project with Fappy Laffertown that just came out is probably the most what was the word you used for me? Authentic.
You know, authentic.
That, that relationship is the most authentic.
So dipping your toe back in that direction a little bit, somebody you wanted to collaborate with.
Actually, it was just for some reason because of the Jangwala Creole group. There was an association. I had developed an association with that music, and somebody put us together for a couple festivals, including the Django Reinhardt Festival mm-hmm. in San Juan. And then the French record label was interested in recording the quartet. So that's how that happened.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, you guys have got about 3 minutes or so before we're going to take our first break. But Evan, who would you say, like, maybe a couple contemporary artists that are catching your attention these days? Either locally or wherever.
Well, I mean, the two musicians I'm working with the most in New Orleans include Don Vappy, the wonderful multi-instrumentalist and mm-hmm. guitarist and banjoist, and David Turkanowski, the pianist. And those two musicians, to me, are very different, but they truly represent people who are anchored very solidly in the tradition and in the culture in which they grew up, and have figured out a way to have all of their influences of all the different types of music that they played throughout their careers and have it kind of become an amalgam of their own personal styles. So I look to them as mentors in
okay.
a way.
Mm-hmm.
For their ability to do that, and to also for their ability to sort of navigate the other pitfalls and the kind of the conditions of our industry
in the contemporary landscape of the industry. Right. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Well, Fermin, same question to you. We have a couple minutes before we take a break. Who you mentioned Rebirth Brass Band when you moved here. Is there somebody you've heard recently in town or someone else that you're admiring or?
Yeah, I admire a lot of people. I don't know if they still live in here, all of them, but also a trombone shorty. When I saw him mm-hmm. like performing live, I said, oh my god, it's so amazing, you know, because I love the power of the horns and the rhythms. I'm in this way too, but also. As an entertainer, I saw just Glenn David Andrews. This is the first people that I can say I can meet directly, and I've been talking to him, and he invited me a couple times to perform with my accordion and his band, and I did, and I said, oh my god, this is something different. You know, it's kind of, sometimes he was like a kind of more like a brass band rhythm, sometimes it's like more bluesy or more rock.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an amazing. I know a lot of musicians here, but the names sometimes I cannot retain it. But I admire also people who work with me with my projects, like the pianist. His name is Jay Gold, and he play a lot around here in Frenchman and out of town too. Mm-hmm. Daiki Hirano, he is from New York in Japan. He's a drummer. And also, in the Latino side, you have Alessé Martí, who is a really good percussionist and composer. You got Alejandro, what we call him Maestro, is like really good. It's many people.
Your ears are always open, right?
And and the Sideco side, his band is really good, like Rakim Dipsy.
Oh,
I've been in touch
yeah.
with him, and his brother is amazing as an accordionist. And
you and I just saw him the other day.
Yeah, I just saw him. Yeah, and Nathan and the Sideco Shasha.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Alexia. I mean, I listened to his newest recording that he pretty much produced himself. And so there's also this other side of musicians. We know them as performers, but we get to know their production skills and abilities.
Right,
and we get to see them express the original side of their music more often than maybe they do for the general public. I think that makes sense.
Good because a lot of people, they know performers just only as a performance, but they have sometimes people have a
The whole process, skills, right? Yeah, the whole process. Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here. We're going to come back and chat further with Fermin and Evan. Take a little break here on the Noah Drink Show. Friends, come on back. All right, everybody, we're back, and we're here with our 2020 iterations of French Quarter Fest series on the Noah Drink Show. Thanks to our good friends here at Louisiana Music Factory, 421 Frenchman Street, and we are chatting with Evan Christopher and Fermin Ceballos. And this is the segment, guys, where we kind of like to talk a little bit about food and drink, even though, it's pretty easy to integrate that stuff into a conversation in New Orleans, whether you're a musician or someone else, right?
The metaphors are endless.
The metaphors are endless. Well, I'll start with you, Evan. So you moved from California to here. You know, what kind of – something catch you off guard, something catch you fancy when you moved here?
So I moved here in the context I was touring with the singer-songwriter from California. We played at Tipitina's. This was summer of 1994. I think it was probably either late June, maybe even early July. Tipitina's didn't have air conditioning back then. We had just played Chicago. Drove the tour bus straight down overnight. I woke up the next morning, you know, on St. Charles Avenue. The bus was looking for the hotel. And everything was just another world, like a, you know, Porky and Wacky Land. You remember that cartoon? Or you know, what's a better example?
Just kind of a surreal
Wizard of Oz.
Sort of experience.
Yeah,
Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
okay,
nothing,
sure.
Nothing was plumb. You know, whatever was sticking out of the ground, whether it was a tree or a telephone pole, was you know, just completely cockeyed, and the air was, you know, super heavy, you know, heavier than anything I'd experienced. And, you know, of course, you see these huge oak trees and cypress trees and things like that that I hadn't really come across. I hadn't done a lot of traveling then, and consequently, I hadn't done a lot of adventurous eating, right? So there we are a couple days early, you know, because we drove straight through. I don't even want to know how fast they were going. And so those 2 days were really the first time that I got to explore. And I think it literally started with a walk pretty much just to Frenchman Street before Frenchman Street was anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really wasn't that much going on. But Praline Connection used to be there. And we literally walked from the hotel on St. Charles, not far from what used to be Lee Circle. And walked all the way over here and had red beans and rice and Praline Connection. I mean, I don't remember why they chose that. It was just where we ended up. And after that, it just became sort of an exploration of the food and the music simultaneously.
They do go hand in hand here, don't they? You can't separate these things.
You really can't. And I think what happened is that was sort of the beginning also of my larger touring experiences outside of the United States where, you know, I mean, there was a lot of I didn't have a lot of experiences with other cultures and their food traditions, mm-hmm. and that started pretty much when I was as a touring musician. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I can't even begin to list the numbers of things that I didn't have that I only had as a young adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I was about in my early 20s then. So
okay,
that includes everything about New Orleans food. That includes everything about, you know, I don't think I even had sushi. I don't think I've even had I don't think I'd had fruits like kiwi. I mean, there's just a lot of things I hadn't had until I was an adult. Touring in these places, all the kinds of cheeses and different kinds of you know, meats and
so it's definitely something when you hit the road that you try and take advantage of.
Absolutely,
right?
And okay. For me, that's, you know, that was kind of what New Orleans was, a part of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. For me, let me ask you this question, because you come from the Dominican Republic.
Yes.
Where can we find good Dominican Republic food in New Orleans? Is it possible?
It's really possible. We got a couple of restaurants across the river. We have a one called Las Delicias. It's 2012 Manhattan Boulevard under Westman on Harvey. And also you got on Gretna another restaurant called Mangu. It's on Velchase. I don't know exactly the... I think before you pass Wall Boulevard, or I think it's Terrytown and Wall Boulevard, that part. Yeah, it's in a little, it's different. It's like a plaza, and they have it up there. It's really, they are really good restaurant. But also, I think on you have on another market on Harvey, and is it like we call Pulgas? Like
yeah,
flea market,
right under the bridge.
Yeah. Yes, they have, I think it's Saturdays and Sundays that you got few people who set up like Dominican cuisine there.
Okay.
And for the weekends, and it's really good.
That's that flea market. Have you ever been there?
No, Evan? I haven't.
Oh, you got to go check it out on the weekends, because a lot of really good Mexican food, a lot of good Honduran food.
Yeah,
a lot of Hondurans. That's really good.
It's really good.
So, like, do you they're very good. You like
these
two places?
Good. Yeah, because it's like homemade food. It's like
it's authentic.
It's authentic. It's like if your mama made it, or your grandma, or the neighbors. You know, it's really good.
Momofogo.
What'd you say?
Momofogo.
Yeah. Momo. Yes, it is. See, but talking about New Orleans food, it's like really similar to the Caribbean food. It's like it's really sazonate, like the flavor. It's really close. Also, when I get gumbo, I said, oh, my God, this is another version of sancocho. We call sancocho in Dominican Republic. It's like kind of gumbo. It's like it's almost – it's too close. I cannot say it's the same, but it's too close. When I take, like, jambalaya, I said, it's like – we can compare that with – we call locrio de arenque. It's like – I don't know how to call arenque on English, but it's like – it's a black fish. And the rice is like almost same. This is close, but also the street food, like a hamburger, all the street food that you can find here in New Orleans is close to the Caribbean. So for me, I get to the place that I have a lot of closer stuff. Talking about food from my country, you know, was like really, in my case, was really, how I can say this. I didn't know that I can find that kind of stuff here, because I used to live for a little bit in New York, and it's the big community, and the Puerto Ricans, Dominicans is out there. So it's easy to find some Dominican food or that flavor. But here, I didn't know that you can find also with the way that they fry the chicken here, the fried chicken here is like too close to the Dominican Republic. You know, it's just all the food in New Orleans has that Caribbean flavor, that Caribbean thing.
A lot of similarity, right? Absolutely.
And also, we musicians, like he said, we perform a lot in different nightclubs, different stuff, different festivals. So one of the good things on festivals here is like if you don't have a time to eat at home, you can go out there after your performance or before your performance, and you can find a great food, you know, anywhere out there. I don't know if you have the experience, but I have. I have just one study guide. It's the Wednesday. The restaurant called Brasa.
Oh, yeah, Churrascaria,
sure. On Metairie Road.
Yeah.
I play every day, Wednesday, 6 p.m. until night. So I had different kind of food from that place. But I tried a hamburger, and now when I'm – not every Wednesday, but most of the Wednesday – you know, they know what I want. You know, this is, I told this because when you play the study gate or regular in a bar or whatever, you know, the people who are working there or are part of the teamwork, sometimes you get a relationship with them too. They know what you want, what is the food, what is the drink. And this is amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Food and
usually good
and
point.
Drinks. Yeah. It's amazing how connect people, how like connect cultures. You know?
Usually absolutely. Good point about the way this community is, not only in terms of its openness of the musicians to other musicians, more about, you know, you get to actually know them off the bandstand. Mm-hmm. You get to actually know, because there's a ton of musicians that cook, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, so cooking really good.
You know, so maybe I had a occupational culture, you know, other places I've been, but it wasn't on the same community level where you're, you know, you're breaking bread with people and, you know, getting to know who's cooking and then having arguments about who's cooking better.
And who's, and
who's cooking, you know, correctly.
Whose mama's recipe for is then, better for whatever, yeah.
The whole idea, like, I know very little about Louisiana culture. You know, I pretty much, this whole time I've been here, I've really mostly been in New Orleans, right? Mm-hmm. But there was a, you know, there was a period kind of that coincided with my arrival where the restaurants were starting to kind of really put those two things together. Mm-hmm. And I think it was driven by the tourism, primarily. But, you know, the whole idea that chefs like Paul Prudhomme started, which was basically a way to combine Louisiana and New Orleans and kind of wrap it up in a nice package for people so that it sort of became the new authentic to put those two worlds together.
Yeah, that's right. A great idea.
And also, on the as a musician, sometimes we rehearse.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you got to eat when you're rehearsing.
Somebody's cooking,
right?
Yeah.
Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take another little break here on the show. We're going to come back and chat a little bit about French Quarter Festival coming up here in April and get these guys' impressions on that. Friends, going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back. Brian Diaz here with you. Yep, it's our French Quarter Fest series. First one of 2020 leading up to French Quarter Festival taking place April 16th through the 19th in the French Quarter. 23 stages, if I'm not mistaken, this year, and it is one of the finest music festivals. I will argue, personally, I'm biased, it is the finest music festival on the planet. Some stuff that we were just talking about during the break, guys, that, you know, the emphasis on local, and it cuts, so it's local musicians, it's local food, and that's what this festival is all about. And Evan, let me ask you, I mean, what does it mean to you, and how long have you been playing?
You know, I mean, I think it's pretty much since I got here in the mid-90s, and, you know, now I think I frame it a little bit differently. I feel like it's on some levels it's gotten a little unwieldy, but, you know, it's if we as musicians just think of it as this is our gift to the city of New Orleans, the same way that, you know, the Mardi Gras crew might think of what their parade is a gift to the city.
Yeah.
If we think about what we're doing as a gift to the city or as a way to say thank you, you know, for the support, then it makes it a little bit easier to kind of navigate that unwieldiness. I mean, I think we're up to over a couple hundred thousand visitors per day of the festival.
Yeah, I think it's been about
three quarters of a million
people.
Yeah, right. So 800,000, whatever, you know. So, I mean, we're talking about some pretty big numbers that definitely make it a little bit harder to get around. But in spite of that, it still hasn't really outgrown its own value system, which is to showcase what we do. And just to have that volume of people in town makes it easier to do shows at night. You know, it's because French Quarter Fest is just mostly the daytime, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're out there and we have people coming specifically for the music of New Orleans. Whatever type of music it is, doesn't matter stylistically. It's still the music of New Orleans, and that's why they're coming. And that's what differentiates it from that other festival.
Right.
And that's what differentiates New Orleans from any other city in the world. Fermin, on the break, we were mentioning that. I think I agree with you. I don't think there is another festival like this anywhere, because I don't think there's another city, even in the United States, where you can say as much about the community's identity through its musical culture.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Fermin, for you, how many is this your first French Quarter Fest performing?
It's my first one.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. Oh, to me, playing at French Quarter Fest is like, it's amazing. It's like to play at home, to play in home for my people and for people who come from other countries and other states, other communities. But I think it's something personally. I feel really happy with that, because I think it's just like, personally, I think, okay, if I'm going to play French Quarter and French Quarter Fest, because my music have some impact in that community, like, and this is great. I assume like my community is like, is getting through my music, is accepting my music and my musical career. And I think as an artist, the first place that you need to be like, I say acceptable and feel like really happy with is with your community and with your people.
Playing where you live, playing to people, with your neighbors.
Gotcha. And okay. New Orleans, I think I'm, you know, I'm trying to, to put all the cards on the table, over the table, so that I'm being rehearsing more with my entire band, and we'll bring a couple different rhythms. We'll bring some cumbias, some merengue, some salsa, some bachata, because it's all of that is Caribbean music, but also it's different type of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of that will be a good show for people who can like dance, who can have fun with the Caribbean music, with, you know, with Dominican music.
Explore some of that.
I feel so happy. For me, it's a gift, like you say.
Yeah.
It's a gift from that community, from God, and from all people involved in it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Evan, do you get a chance, do you like to wander around the festival when you're not playing and check people out if you get time to do that?
I've been pretty judicious about my wandering. I feel like it's become generally accepted that Thursday is sort of the locals' day.
Used to be Friday, and then now it's Thursday.
There's the kind of extra day. I tend to favor the Thursday and the Sundays as my days to kind of do the, not only do the wandering, but do the eating, because I find, you know, in the middle 2 days, it gets a little bit harder. I also, you know, I have a 3.5-year-old, so it's a little bit tricky, and I think what I'm also finding, I think the kind of one of the best secrets I don't think a lot of people know is get, you know, if you can get in and out before noon, you'll have beat a lot of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think and the heat. I mean, it can be pretty warm, but I think people don't realize that if you can kind of hit it early, and if you can perform early, it's even better too, because you know, you got all the time in the world to set up. It's actually a pretty peaceful part of the festival, that first couple hours.
Absolutely right.
That's something that I've found. I think my responsibilities for evening shows has made it a little harder in a way to spend as much time. But I always make sure that if I'm playing at the festival, I just give myself a couple hours on either side of it, so that I can kind of, even if I just stay right there, you know, I'm sure to catch a few friends and
grab a bite and grab a drink.
That's exactly.
Well, you guys, we got about 2.5 minutes before I got to close out the radio portion of the show. Evan, where are you playing and what days?
The first thing I'm doing is actually David Torkanowski and I are going to be performing at the patrons party at the Fillmore, which is March 6th. And that's something that people can be involved in if they want to support the festival. And then for the actual festival, we're on Clarinet Road is on Sunday. Morning around 12:30 to 2:00, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. We'll share all this on our website too, and on the show notes, so people can catch where you're playing. Fermin, where are you all playing?
Okay, I played weekly, just Wednesday at Brasa Churrascaria on Metairie Road, but just me and my guitar. It's a solo performance.
Okay.
I love it. Talking about French Quarter Fest, I'll be playing Saturday 18, 1:45. I think 1:45 until 3, something like that, 3 p.m.
Okay.
It's on one of the main stages, but I really don't know what it's now. But I can send it to you when I have the information.
Yeah, we'll have that in the show notes, so that, no problem at all. Well, and Evan, what's your website? And
everything with me is Clarinet Road.
Okay.
Clarinet Road, R-O-A-D, clarinetroad.com is the website, and a little bit on social media.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. And do you have some regular gigs around town, too?
Not really. Pretty limited to, you know, special concerts a few times a month. Month of March, I'll be I'm doing a residency at Chickiwawa in Mid-City every Monday night.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And real quick, website and social?
Website is josefermin.com, and the social media is @FerminMusica or @FerminMusica.
Okay.
Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Perfect.
At Fermin Musica and at Merengue 4.
Awesome. We'll link to that on the website as well when the show's out, guys. Well, thanks very much for being here. You guys are going to stick around for another Shot with Noah Drinks, which is our podcast-only segment. We're going to talk a little bit about music education, passing on the traditions, maintaining the traditions of music. But, friends, if you are listening on the radio, I do encourage you to go to noahdrinks.com and get the podcast, because you'll only hear that conversation that we're about to have there. But if you are listening on the radio, thanks, friends. Remember to be kind to one another and use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all. Another Shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, hope everyone had a good and safe Mardi Gras out there. Hope you're enjoying this conversation with Evan and Fermin, part of our French Quarter Fest series. We'll have a little bit more of that before the festival, another installment thereof of our French Quarter Fest series. We're going to bounce right back over to Louisiana Music Factory, continue our conversation with those guys, and then we will have our inaugural segment for Liquid Luggage. Here we go. Yep, another Shot with Noah Drinks, friends. Thanks for listening in. I do appreciate it this week, as always. And I do want to encourage you to stick around after this segment when we continue our conversation here with Evan and Fermin. We are going to have the inaugural segment of our Liquid Luggage installment. Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of good spirits education stuff that we got coming up. Evan got a buddy of mine that he's a broker, and he brings in spirits from all over the world. And so we play cocktail and talk about some rare spirits. Or not just, I won't say rare, but unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got that coming up after you guys. And that's the first one we're doing, so I'm encouraging people to stay around for that one. But we're talking about you guys, we're talking about French Quarter Fest, talked about a little bit about food music, got a little bit of a background here from Evan and Fermin. And one of the questions I always like to ask when we do this series during this segment is sort of the importance of the generational aspect of music and preserving the culture and what that means. And I think here, and I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I think here in New Orleans, it's largely, in most instances, understood this need to perpetuate the culture and, you know, mentor people or be mentored by people.
I agree. It is understood. However, that intergenerational model has, in my opinion, suffered over the last two or three generations, maybe three or four generations. And I think, although we presume that this music and these traditions are handed down from generation to generation, I think we have some serious kind of holes in that continuity, and that comes from a number of things that I've witnessed. I think partly it's psychological. I mean, you know, people don't grow up wanting to play their father's music necessarily. maybe they come back to it eventually.
Right, right.
But I think more to the point, our overdependence on tourism here in New Orleans has contributed a lot to perceptions of what's viable as cultural activity instead of what's essential about cultural activity. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think there's become, with the younger generations, I think there's become a more of a focus on, you know, okay, you know, what do I have to do in the music, or what do I have to do to get mine, or seeing somebody and saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to follow them, and that's how I'm going to get mine. Instead of understanding or being truly connected to their own community, and instead of the music continuing to have an essential role mm-hmm. in the way the community grows and develops. I can't blame that entirely on you know, the overdependence on tourism. You know, other fingers you can, you know, you can point to. You can point a finger at gentrification. You mm-hmm. can point a finger
the
at
the internet, right?
You can point a finger at what's happened to the privatization model for our schools and how that's sort of decimated the community identity. Now the kids are actually, you know, commuting an hour and a half every morning to some other part of town. Yeah, so there's a lot of things that and then just the way that music is marketed and the way that musicians are perceived. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, I think in this environment we're perceived less often as the culture bearers that we are, as relevant to the community, and we're perceived more as extensions of the service and hospitality industry. Mm-hmm. So that's just my two cents about that. So I will agree that nobody disputes how important it is that we hand these traditions down. What I'm saying is that I think we're seeing some gaps in that infrastructure to make that possible.
That's really well said, Evan. And you're actually, other folks have said similar things. Not everybody, but other folks when we've done this segment. Tim Lachlan, our mutual friend, actually kind of brought up some of those same points last year when we did the show. And I think, you know, when we talk about these issues connected to the culture that we sell in New Orleans, right, is based on largely on music and largely on service and hospitality, because it's the culinary tradition that we have here. That is the lifeblood of what we do. And the culture bearers such as yourself who play music, or the chefs who are in the kitchens, these are the people that are providing the raw material, the fuel, if you will, for the tourism economy here. And supporting that and understanding that aspect of continuing to organically fertilize it, I think, is critical.
And organic fertilizer is that's a good metaphor. Maybe the organic part is more
a little
strong. There's a lot of fertilizer out there. Uh-huh. But yeah, for the culture to be able to develop organically the way that, and I don't know if there were I'm reluctant to say that there were actually any halcyon days for culture happening, but let's just say that on the neighborhood level, mm-hmm. I think we're losing the ability to connect and support the culture bearers who make that possible.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Fermin, because then I want to come back to you, Evan, and ask what you think, some things maybe that we can do about it. But as somebody who hasn't lived in New Orleans for a particularly long period of time, how did you feel when you stepped in as a new musician in New Orleans into the culture and into the community?
For me, it was and is still being a great experience to be a new musician on the city. To meet people, learn from different New Orleans music styles, but also on talking about my Latino side, musically talking. So, I think we as Latinos or Caribbean musicians here, I think we need to keep growing up in as a community and as a musician, because we do play a lot of traditional stuff from the Caribbean, let me see, mm-hmm. from Cuba, from Dominican Republic, from also the Honduras people who play puntas mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and I think this is great. But I didn't observe in my community new compositions, mm-hmm. and I'm worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I'm worried about that. And also, I have a deeply, deeply respect, and I'm lucky about to being a musician in New Orleans and how to be involved in the New Orleans music, but I have observed this in the New Orleans music too.
Mm-hmm. seeing newly created music.
Not as much.
Or not as much as
used. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
You don't need to drop off the rhythms, the styles, the things like that. But if we want to continue the traditions and New Orleans music, no matter if it's jazz, if it's brass band, if it's salsa, if it's Latin jazz, we need to be and we need to create as a past mentors of us, they did. I observe this. We kind of stuck on that.
Okay.
And
constantly
play,
looking
and play
backwards.
And play same stuff. And I don't have nothing, again, to play the same stuff because I've been playing the same stuff for years with my band. I've been playing Merengue Típico for like now about 20 years, 18 years. But we who play accordion or we who play guitar, sometimes we don't have the ability to compose. But we got people around who got those abilities to compose. So we got to make a team. We got to create new music. And then we are create different sounds. And also, we still have the tradition, but we still have something new based on the tradition. This is my point of view.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Thank you. Evan, what would you like to add to that? I know you may, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I totally agree with what resonates to me is the idea that, you know, there's some people, their wheelhouse is actually creating that new music, and some people, their wheelhouse is performing it. And it's not necessarily always the same people. Mm-hmm. Both sets of people need to have more infrastructure where they're actually encouraged to do that. So if you have a city that's marketing our musical culture and saying that, you know, if you trip over a street musician, you can cross music off your list, you know, which is really what, if you look at their advertising, it's basically what's implied.
Yes.
You know, instead of recognizing that there's many different tiers and many different aspects to New Orleans music, different points of entry. And with 18 million visitors a year now?
Yeah, I think it's even more than that.
It could
be.
Yeah. Depends on who you ask, okay? Yeah. So, you know, UNO has probably better statistics than the New Orleans Tourism Marketing Company. They inflate theirs and you know, whatever. Right. Whether it is, okay, even if it's even anywhere near that.
Yep.
We're talking 40 to 50,000 people daily, every day of the year. Musicians like Fermin and myself, we don't actually need thousands of people to be coming to our shows. We need dozens. Right? What did we say about earlier? Snug Harbor? I mean, it's our most acclaimed listening room. Well, that's only 170 people a night.
And the over two shows. So,
well,
like
I mean,
saying,
85
yeah,
times
right,
two.
So people, yeah, people don't.
So,
know.
So we really don't need that. You know, as far as the, you know, being able to reach 107. What'd I say? 40,000 visitors a day.
Yeah.
If we can reach 200 of that 40,000 people a day, we're cool. And you know, there's enough diversity in the scene that if we just had a way to reach them, that could happen, and gradually that would push the level of creativity, that would drive creativity, because you know we're not, because it hasn't been dumbed down and people aren't. You know, the marketing, there's other types of marketing that accept things at different levels or different points of entry into the experience.
Okay, and let me ask you this, because then, like, if you're saying, and I like what you said, that some people are more, they lean more towards composition, others lean more towards performance, but is it a situation where maybe we have people that want to do both, but now they're forced to gig so often to make a living that takes away their ability to produce new music?
I mean, that does happen. That does happen. There's so much pressure on us as musicians to be what you might call a solopreneur. You know, entrepreneurs on a very individual level, and basically forced to be able to have to take time out of our day to do our own marketing and have to do our own bookkeeping, our own organization. It sometimes takes quite a bit of time away from the activity of preparing and curating the shows that we want to, or the experiences that we want to do.
Recording, writing, right? If
you
that's
know,
what
so,
you do.
So it could be, there could definitely be more infrastructure on the production end. All of it needs to be just, it can be driven if the demand becomes higher. And the way the demand would become higher is when people, when even if it's a small minority of that, 18, 20 million visitors, you know, is actually looking for something that's a different experience. Repeat visitors are a part of the key, instead of people just saying, oh, wow, I went to New Orleans. Next. No, right. We need people that are going to come back every year.
And we have those, right? We do have those.
We do. Yeah. We do. They're going to be challenged. They're going to be challenged because of what's happening with our climate and the precariousness of the city. Those repeat visitors are going to be gradually challenged. They're being challenged because there's other places competing for their attention. And I think they're going to be challenged because they're having trouble themselves finding those other experiences that kind of gradually are more meaningful and richer.
Mm-hmm.
Like the people are starting to them. They come to us. They come to Fermin and me. They come to us and they complain all the time about, well, I didn't know how to find you, or I didn't know, you know, how do I find, you know, they're asking us mm-hmm. because the filters and the outlets for letting them know what's happening aren't detailed enough or nuanced enough. So I think there's some infrastructure there.
That's really interesting points, because I think, like you said, Evan, where you look on the surface, if you go look at certain tourism websites and things like that, you would think, oh, it's actively being promoted. It's front and center of everything. But that breakdown in connectivity is a really fascinating point. And something that we obviously need to address then.
They lost me when they started their campaigns around 2007, 2008, when the city was just coming back to, this is a statistic that people don't remember, that 80% of the musicians in town came back before half the population.
Mm.
And that created a very strange supply-side heavy shift in what we were doing. And tourism marketing lost me when they started bragging about visitors being able to come to Frenchman Street and hear free music.
Mm-hmm.
When they started bragging about the music being free, that creates a bit of a problem for us.
It undermines the value of the product, right?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, correct.
Exactly. Right.
The onus shouldn't be on us to continually push on finding. Finding the people that we're looking for. I think mm-hmm. there's way too much pressure on us as the artists to not only create those other experiences that kind of raise the bar, but to let people know that there are other points of entry into the experience of New Orleans music. I don't think I don't think we should be shouldering all of that responsibility.
Fair enough.
So that's basically my two cents about what I think needs to happen next in order for that to happen.
I appreciate that. And you guys, we could continue this conversation forever. We'll do it again because I've got to cut away here and then come back with our liquid luggage segment. But Evan, one more time, tell people where they can find you online.
You know, it's Clarinet Road.
Okay.
Clarinet, ROAD Road. .com is the website and a little bit on social media.
Awesome. Fermin, where can we find you?
At Fermin Musica or at Merengue 4 will be on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And my website is josefermin.com.
Perfecto. Yeah. So we'll make sure we link up to all your stuff.
Great, thank you.
Guys.
And
thank you.
Evan, Fermin, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure
so
chatting with you.
To be here with you, Brian.
Cool. Well, and we'll see you at French Quarter Fest.
Absolutely. Hope to see you there.
Yeah, friends, be sure to check out fqfest.org April 16th yeah. through the 19th. And thanks to Louisiana Music Factory here, 421 Frenchman Street.
Yeah.
Again, friends, brief musical interlude, and we'll be back with Phil and Liquid Luggage. All right, everybody, yep, Liquid Luggage, friends. We are here talking with Phil Minasalli, our good friend, spirits educator, consultant, broker, PM Brokerage. And we're here, as you know, kick off our inaugural segment of Liquid Luggage. We're going to educate you about the world of spirits and other things. We have a man who has a bag full of bottles. He does travel, and he brings them to share with us. Phil, buddy, happy to kick this off with you, man.
I'm happy to be here. Well, couldn't have picked a better day. Get over to the North Shore.
Yeah. I think we'll be doing this in New Orleans quite a bit, but we're starting off just because we want to throw y'all a curveball. We are here at Grateful Ape, the Ape Cave, a very fine new bar in Old Mandeville. We'll get you some specs on them shortly, but we're tasting some really interesting stuff, Phil, and you brought several things in your bag, the liquid luggage, and the first thing that we're going to taste here is the La Madre Vermouth.
Yes, yeah. So just so happened I had a couple of things in my bag today that were from Spain. So we've got a Spanish vermouth that I brought. This is their red, so you could think of it like a sweet vermouth. what this company has done. They're fairly young, and they're kind of playing on where vermouth is landing now in a low ABV cocktail. So the idea behind this brand in particular is they're introducing like some nice fun flavor to it. So they'll do like they've got a white vermouth that has like bits of like apples that are part of the maceration process. This one is really beautiful. I think it follows like a little bit more of like the traditional processes. So you're dealing with like 32 different botanicals that are in this. This comes from a town. I don't want to mess up. Terra Alta is the area, and the town is called Tarragona, which is west on the coast by Barcelona,
okay.
a little further west. And the idea is they're really introducing like a fun version of vermouth. This is like you could treat it as a table vermouth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun one to introduce. They do have a red. They've got a white. They've got a dry. They have a reserve. So it's a variety of different ones.
Yeah, I like it a lot, man, because it's got that sweetness, as you said, you would expect in a sweet vermouth. But there's a nice set of botanicals. There's a nice savory note to it that I really enjoy as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about agave distillates and mezcal, but this one of my favorite Negroni spins is a mezcal Negroni, and this would be a perfect vermouth to go with that, I think.
Absolutely, and this particular vermouth uses two types of grapes. It'll use the Grenache, and it'll use the, the Macabeo.
Okay.
Those grapes from Spain are going to be in this particular vermouth.
Terrific. Yeah, it's a wonderful vermouth, easy drinker, very approachable. So what about this gin is one of my new favorite gins on the market these days, the Mahon gin, also from Spain.
Also, so if you were to think of where this is located, now go back to Barcelona, then hop on a plane about an hour south, not Mallorca. There's another island east of that that has the town Mahon.
Mm-hmm. Menorca,
and, yeah, in Menorca.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mallorca, Menorca.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to mix them up. Anyways, it's like a bioreserve. It's beautiful. This distillery actually is on the beach. And what sets it aside is when you think about how a gin is made, what do you typically think that this is going to be made from?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a grain-based. This is a grape-based.
Mm-hmm.
So you are looking at almost like a grappa, like a just distilled to the point where you have a grape-based distillate, fairly neutral, but still has a little bit of that present. I don't think you can avoid it.
You know, one of the things I like about it, Phil, is that, and listeners know this and you know this about me, I'm not a huge London dry guy, just my own personal taste, not trying to dissuade anyone from anything, of course. This is not, the juniper is not overwhelming on this. It sits in nice balance, and you actually get the grape distillate aspect of it comes through very, very nicely.
Yeah. I haven't had the pleasure of visiting this distillery yet. It's part of the plan. it's almost part of how I approach spirits now. It's like, where would I like to visit? Let's work with the spirit from there.
This tastes good. I want to go there. I like that. There you go. There is liquid luggage in a nutshell, buddy, in a bag. There is liquid luggage in a bag.
There you go. So when I saw the images of this particular distillery that is on the beach, they have these open windows, and you can get the salinity on this particular spirit.
Absolutely.
And that salinity is imparting itself on the juniper that is drying, you know, that is out at the distillery before it's introduced into the spirit.
Okay, very cool. Now, one of my favorites that we're going to move on to a mezcal El Bujo, the owl in Spanish, an Espadín, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
we're rolling along here.
Yeah, we are rolling along. We are trying to bring it to you quickly here on Liquid Luggage, as we do and will do. I love this. And El Bujo, just they do a bunch of different expressions of mezcal, and all of them are really good. And sort of their workhorse go-to is the Espadín that we're tasting now.
Like most, artisanal production distilleries, palenques, as they call them in Oaxaca. This is coming from Santiago Matatlan. This is the epicenter of Oaxaca mezcal production in Oaxaca. So when you think about all mezcals that come from Mexico right now, about 95% of them are coming from Oaxaca as the state. 80% of those of that of that 95 that makes the whole is coming from Santiago Matatlan.
Okay.
So this is the largest producer of mezcal.
And this is really lovely stuff. I get a nice sort of berry note on this.
Yeah, there is some citrus present on it, so it's not a complete smoke bomb, as people say in the industry. It is an approachable introductory mezcal. It's perfect for cocktails. We actually have it in the liter bottle for the bars specifically, so this can be used and is user-friendly for folks behind the bar to mess with. Another thing to remember about these types of mezcals is there's a huge focus on sustainability. So El Buho, as producers, this is a five-generation family. This is a recipe that dates back to 1880, and they are going above and beyond to ensure that they are continually producing more mezcal, more agave, planting more pups, through asexual and sexual reproduction of the agave species.
Okay.
And basically that's to ensure that if, a virus or a bacteria were to impart itself on one crop, it can't infect the whole lot,
So you have the biodiversity, which is something that we talk about with mezcal being incredibly important.
And I know you've
important.
Done a show several shows specifically. So look back in the archives, folks, and it's an amazing show that talks about the sustainability of agave.
Absolutely. We'll share that date with you in the show notes too, friends. This is such a wonderful expression of mezcal that the balance is fantastic. It shows the characteristic. It's sort of, we use that term in wine, right, Phil? Varietally correct.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing maybe to say in this case, but it is varietally correct. And I'm just a huge fan of everything that Buho does, frankly.
Yeah, they're putting out amazing Espadín, consistent Espadín, as well as the Especial, Stobala, Tempestate, Jabalí, which is one
awesome.
That you, yeah, awesome.
The Jabalí is awesome.
Awesome. One that a lot of mezcaleros don't really mess with either because of what it can do to your stills. There can be some serious damage done to you.
That's also,
equipment.
Isn't that like a semi-wild harvest is the Jabalí, or is that more?
Jabalí is a wild.
It's totally wild.
Yeah,
okay.
These are like ones that you'll see grow in the on the hillsides, on the mountainsides, all across Oaxaca.
Awesome.
And harvesting the agaves is a pain in the butt, but also using it and fermenting and distilling it is a pain as well.
Okay.
So
let's do this. So we're going to taste a whiskey here, the Amrit single malt.
Yes.
Tell us about this one, because this is my first time tasting this particular guy.
Yes. Single malt from India. This comes from Bangalore, 3,000 feet above sea level. So that's, I mentioned the elevation because it plays a significant factor in the outcome of the whiskey. The elevation and the climate is going to change the evaporation point of the whiskey annually. So when you think about whiskeys that are made in Scotland, and this follows in the Scottish traditions, it's obviously an influence from, the English influence in India.
In India, right.
So there is a big whiskey consumption. Actually, India is the largest consuming country of whiskey.
Okay.
Most of this is blended stuff that comes out from distilleries across India. However, this single malt is really special. A good majority of it is actually for export because they wanted to prove. Amrut was established in 1948, but as a rum distillery, and they were putting out rum from sugarcane and what's called jaggery, like a very it's essentially making a candy, and then they're pressing it and squeezing it with a cheesecloth, and you get these hard sugar clumps together, and they use that to make rum. And it wasn't until 2000, I'd say mid-90s, they started actually messing with the wheat that's grown there. So the barley is a different species of barley. Two-row barley is common for Scotch whiskies that are made in Scotland. This is a six-row barley. So it's a different species of barley. So you're getting that in the palate, but you're also looking at the quick aging of this whiskey comes to play when you're looking at the elevation and the climate of India. Very hot, high elevations. This increases the evaporation point, but also will increase the ABV in the barrel.
Okay, sure.
So makes when you sense. Put it in the barrel, it might come out even more alcohol because of what is happening by the evaporation of the water.
Okay,
Because typically, this is common in whiskey. You are cutting the whiskey before it goes into the barrel.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Because you're going to yield more over a period of time.
Okay.
Right. And you're diluting it to a sense. This one is going into the barrel at a certain ABV, but it's coming out with less whiskey in the barrel. So look at evaporation points of Scotland, which range from 3.5 to maybe 5% at most. This one is an average of 10% annually. So look at what's okay. going to happen to that whiskey in 9 years. You're going to have a tenth of like what you had. You're going to have just a little bit what's left in that barrel.
And it has that that Solera oxidative note to it, which is really, really lovely. So I really like this because if I blinded this, I would have guessed Scotch. Mm-hmm. But there's a viscosity and a mouthfeel to it that I would have said, maybe not.
Yeah, and Amrut has put out releases where they've used Scottish malt and introduced it. One of the best-selling whiskeys that they have is one called Fusion, which is taking this one, the Amrut single malt, which is 100% barley from India, produced in India, but it will actually use the Scottish barleys and blend it together.
Awesome. Great products. What we're going to do, friends, is we're going to take a brief pause, and then we're going to be joined by a very talented bartender, Paul Kalikas, here at the Ape Cave Grateful Ape in Old Mandeville, and he's going to showcase us some cocktails that he's created using the things that you've just heard about here. Hang on 1 second. All right, so we're joined here by Paul Kalikas, head bartender at the Ape Cave Grateful Ape. And Paul has created three wonderful cocktails using the products that we just talked about here. Paul, what's the first one, man? It's a gin drink using the Mahone gin.
So the first drink we got going on here is the Some Assembly Required. Did a little bit of research a while back, just reading on kind of Spanish drink culture, and noticed that there's a lot of things going on there, kind of a gin and tonic. And that's basically what I did here. This is the Mahone gin, just nice and light, a little bit of salinity to it. And then it is, again, fancy kind of gin and tonic. Did a little butterfly pea in there for the pretty color. And then the tonic that we're using is Fentimans, just nice, super citrusy.
Yeah, and what we're going to do, friends, just so you know, is all the specs, builds of the drinks, we're going to publish these for you, so you can just go check out the website and check out Liquid Luggage at NolaDrinks.com, and you will find those there. Phil, what are your thoughts on this one?
That's beautiful.
Awesome. Lovely beautiful. Drink. So tell us about the... Go ahead.
Just like nice citrus kind of exploding into the mouth.
Grapefruit pops on it. It's fantastic.
The salinity is present from the Mahone. I think it complements that specific gin.
Beautiful. What about the El Bujo Mezcal drink that we got here?
So this is something I was inspired by. I call this one a Wild Night in Oaxaca.
I've had one of those.
I'm sure. So it's the El Bujo Mezcal, Granada Valet, the Daristi Stabentun, which I've loved for years.
You got that guy sitting right there.
It's just great stuff. The drink, there's a little bit of complexity to it, but it's very accessible as well.
Makes the El Bujo shine, I think, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think, Phil?
Oh, yeah. And Daristi, been producing this product since like the 1930s. It's an old recipe. That's like a honey anise liqueur. It kind of is a play on the old agua miel, which is, it's contested as like one of the first alcoholic beverage that ever came to be naturally.
Yeah, lovely anise note on this. We've talked about that one on the show before. It's highly recommended. And the Amrut cocktail that you did, buddy.
So last but not least, this is the, we're calling this one Bollywood Nights. Took the single malt Amrut. It's got a nice little bit of sweetness to it. I paired that up with some, the puree that I made with some garam masala spiced apples and the La Madre vermouth. A little bit of heat to it. Nice, not cloyingly sweet, but there's a nice sweetness to it. The spice, it works really well with that.
Awesome. Do me a favor, while we're tasting this one, Paul, tell people where they can find a Grateful Ape in the Ape Cave over here, buddy. And online and on the street, as we say.
So we are at 2013 Jefferson Street in Old Mandeville. If you want to look us up, we are gratefulape.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Awesome. Paul, thank you very much. Come check him out. Fantastic drinks. Phil, where do we connect with the different brands and you and find out? I mean, I know they're kind of all over the map. But.
Yeah. A good way to kind of see what I do is my website. That's Phil M Brokerage. Phil, P-H-I-L-M as in Mary, brokerage.com. And that's the best way to see everything that's in the liquid luggage bag.
There you go.
Day to day.
This is the first installment, friends, of Liquid Luggage. We'll be doing it again with our good friend Phil Minasalli. Thanks to the Grateful Ape in the Ape Cave, Paul Kalikas, Anthony Carissa over here. And stay tuned for another one coming up in the near future. Go to our website, noladrinks.com. You'll find the builds, cocktail video demos, how to connect with Phil, and how to see more about the brands. Friends, I'll be right back with my parting shot.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show. I do appreciate it, friends, this week, as always. Hope you enjoyed our French Quarter Fest series. Hope you enjoyed our inaugural installment of Liquid Luggage there with our good friend Phil Minasalli of PM Brokerage, as well as our good friend Paul Kalikas there at the Ape Cave, Grateful Ape, and Old Mandeville. Go check them out. Great bar program. I would argue the only really good bar program on the North Shore. And so if you live in New Orleans and you haven't been over the North Shore in a while, go check it out. It's worth the drive. Some cool stuff going on. And if you're coming to visit and you want to get out of Dodge and go check out the lakefront and stuff like that outside of the city, it's pretty. It's pretty mellow. All that good stuff. Be sure to go check out the Ape Cave and a Grateful Ape. Don't really have a parting shot for you because it was a pretty long show. We want to encourage you to check out future episodes of Liquid Luggage when you can. And we also want to encourage you to go check out PM Brokerage, their website, philmbrokerage.com, P-H-I-L-M as in Mary, brokerage.com. We'll be bringing you a lot more from the world of craft spirits, interesting cocktails, show you the demos, publish the recipes, talk about the spirits, all stuff that if you're a bartender, you can bring into your bar, or all stuff that if you're a home enthusiast and a home bartender, you can get these products and you can make these drinks at home and impress your friends. That's Liquid Luggage. And that's our parting shot. Here's to you.